Hello and welcome to Build Momentum, a show where we explore thought leadership and education. I'm Sarah Williamson, the founder of SWPR Group.
And I'm Katie Lash, the director of the East Central Educational Service Center.
Together, we explore how to leverage key partners, your constituencies, and the media to authentically impact your organizations and the leaders who champion them. We can't wait to get started, so let's dive into today's show. On today's episode, we're so excited to have Aaron Mote on the show. Aaron is the executive director and co-founder of Innovate EDU. Aaron, I'm so honored to have you here. I'm sure Katie feels the same way. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm super excited to chat with y'all.
Aaron, it's great. We haven't met, although I do follow you on LinkedIn, or we're connections on LinkedIn now. But would you share a little bit more about Innovate EDU and the important work that you are doing?
Thanks for asking. I founded Innovate EDU now 9 years ago. And when I say that out loud, frankly, it just makes me feel old. But one of the things that I love about Innovate EDU is we're really an organization that's deeply connected to what's happening in the field through various networks and coalitions that we run, as well as programs that are actually field-based at the charter school I founded in Brooklyn, New York. One of the things that we're really working on at Innovate EDU is creating uncommon alliances to drive large-scale social change. And this ecosystem approach really comes from my background as an enterprise architect. I'm a technologist and an enterprise architect, and so I only see or think in systems. And when I think about education, I think we have to pull many levers at the same time in order to support the field, to support policy, research, and practice coming together to really make the type of massive, disruptive, radical change I think we need right now in education.
I love that you bring that background because it's so important and so vital to what we need in education. And you've so cleverly created some organizations, including Project Unicorn, which I wanted to talk to you about today, because I know that organization was your brainchild and it's been around for quite a few years. Will you tell us about how you founded Project Unicorn? You know, what led to that inception? Just a little more about it.
Yeah, I love to say that it was just my idea, but like I just said, the things that happen at Innovate EDU often come from the field. And so we host a community of practice at Innovate EDU, our longest running community of practice, actually, the DataWiz community, which is made up of folks who are doing data and technology work in schools and districts across the country. They're the smartest people I know who are working in these issues. And we were having our inaugural convening in Brooklyn, New York. And one of the things we decided to do as a group was begin to try to get our arms around what tools we were all using, what ed tech we were all using. And I just want to put everybody in the Wayback Machine that this was about 2015. And so like not when technology was proliferating schools quite the way it has today.
That is the Wayback Machine.
That is the Wayback Machine.
Such a long ago.
A long time ago and in a really different environment. And so we had two tech leaders, I won't give away any more secrets than that, sitting side by side. And we were working in this spreadsheet because, again, you know, what's the easiest way sometimes to collect the information and the most accessible is something we really pride ourselves on at Innovate EDU. And so, you know, they're typing the same product name and they're typing the same sort of use of the product. And one of them is a large urban school district in the middle of the country. The other is a charter network that spans multiple states on the East Coast. And they start typing the same sales rep. And then they get to sort of how they integrate their tools. And guess what? It's the exact same way, right? So they've achieved interoperability in the exact same way. And then there's a column that says, what does it cost you? And one person enters zero and the other person enters a six-figure number. And so this story is sort of illustrative of something that was happening in ed tech, that depending on the relationship you had with your sales rep, depending on your district size, depending on, you know, what the sort of privilege that you might have coming into a sales transaction, maybe someone was trying to make the sale, maybe someone was trying to keep you as a customer. Functionally, you know, someone was paying nothing for interoperability and someone was paying six figures, which for me just equates to about, you know, at least 2.5 teachers in New York City. And so, you know, this idea that data interoperability is really something that is widespread in other industries, banking, healthcare, the way you use your Bluetooth headphones with the computer that you're listening on right now, the way you use your ATM card at any bank. These things were ubiquitous in other sectors. And in K-12, they were either something that we were paying for as schools, or they were something that just wasn't commonplace. And so it became really clear to me that this was a business problem, not a technology problem. And how do you solve business problems? You work at the supply side and the demand side. And so we rallied a group of initial organizations, about 12, to a steering committee to really take this on. Digital Promise, COSIN, DQC, these organizations who don't often come together, but new data interoperability was such a big issue for schools, districts, and states, all said, we're going to commit to radical change for K-12 in data interoperability. And what's remarkable about this coalition is not only is it still hanging together from that initial 12, but it's expanded now to 18 organizations, and we stayed together, and we're all rowing in the same direction, and we're supporting schools, districts, and states, and we come together and share and coordinate how we collect data, how we provide information to the field, how we, you know, drive understanding of what's happening in the space, how we work with vendors, how we work with districts, states, and LEAs. That type of coordinated work is a movement. And so these organizations have committed to a movement, invited the supply side and the demand side, vendors, districts, and states to the table. And I think now when I look at where interoperability is and the awareness around interoperability in our space, this movement has really catalyzed understanding, knowledge, and frankly, I think lowered the total cost of operating for a school district with their data. And so I'm incredibly proud of the work of Project Unicorn, but it really came from educators, two educators who took the time to share information, to zone in on their problem, and then a group of organizations who has been committed in coming together to really transform the education space. I think that's remarkable. I think that's the type of uncommon alliances we need in this space. And I'm incredibly proud to be the lead unicorn, but certainly it's a herd of unicorns. It's yeah. Not just one.
I love that, Erin. Congratulations. That's so remarkable that it's still going strong. And I feel like, I think you're absolutely right. We need more of this. How do we solve other problems? There's so many. We need these coalitions to come together for these solutions. So that's amazing. Great work.
Thanks.
Yes. So I'm just learning more about your work here, Erin. So tell us a few more of the impressive ideas and tools that you've seen come of your coalitions. This is super interesting. And like all folks that we've interviewed on here, I want to talk about this offline too.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'll just name a couple of the other large coalitions that we've built at Innovate EDU. One that comes to mind immediately is our Pathways Alliance. It's the only coalition we co-founded with another organization. There, we're working with the incredible Learning Policy Institute as our co-founder of that coalition. And that's really focused on creating inclusive pathways for educators into the profession. So a couple things that the Pathways Alliance has already done in less than a year, so impressive. They've released a national definition of a teacher residency to ensure that when a state is building policy or a school district is building a teacher residency, or an institution of higher education is thinking about a teacher residency, that they're taking the best research, policy, and practice we've seen in the sector and implementing a set of principles that ensures that teacher residencies are inclusive, that they support diverse candidates, and that they do it in a way that's really equitable and prioritizes the learning experience of those candidates. And frankly, in the long term, we've seen when teacher candidates have a great onboarding experience, a great residency experience, they stay in the profession longer, they tend to matriculate into leadership roles, and just by and large, they tend to be more diverse and reflective of the communities that they serve. Right now, that alliance, as announced at the White House last year, is working on writing the national guidelines for teacher apprenticeships alongside the U.S. Department of Education and the U.S. Department of Labor and a coalition of organizations within Pathways. Those will be coming out in spring, and I'm really excited to see, again, us holding up through a coalition of diverse actors, right? So our friends from labor unions, our friends from institutions of higher education, our friends from the field who are actually implementing apprenticeships, all coming together around the same table, talking about how to close that research policy and practice divide, and hopefully generate something for the field that creates not just what we should be doing, but really what the desired outcome of that paradigm shift is around teacher pathways, so that we're really focusing on the types of onboarding we're doing into the profession, the types of working conditions we create for our educators, and how we're really thinking about educators as being durable careers over the long term. That's something Pathways is really focused on. Then I'll bring up one other that I'm so proud of that we founded during the pandemic in March 2020, because, you know, what else are you going to do but found an uncommon alliance of folks, more than 125 organizations who have come together to really create a new coalition around students with learning differences and students with disabilities, the Educating All Learners Alliance. I'm so proud of the work that ELA has done throughout the pandemic, but also the work it's doing now to really put students with disabilities at the center of the conversation. You know, at ELA, we talk about shoveling the ramp, not shoveling the stairs, so that when you design for the widest use case possible, that you can actually make education more inclusive for all students. And we just worked with the Texas Virtual Education Commission to forward some recommendations about how to make virtual education the most inclusive practice possible for young people who have disabilities. And so the ELA work is more broad and more diverse than that, but really some huge highlights of, again, this uncommon coalition of civil rights organizations, K-12 organizations, parent organizations, regional organizations, local organizations, and the big nationals coming together and say, you know what, we can work together differently, we can bring different expertise, and there's really a way to push this work forward in a transformative and impactful way.
Wow, I'm speechless. Erin, you're so impressive. This is amazing.
Well, I'm an amazing team. Like, that is the first thing I will say, is that I have an amazing team of people who are just mission-oriented warriors for change. And impact is the center of their core values. And that's really what makes this work possible.
Yeah, that's so important. Okay, what if someone said, gosh, I really want to create an alliance, or I really think we need a coalition about X? Where do they start? Because that sounds very daunting. Could you just kind of break that down for us? Just, I'm very curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to start and end with trust. So, you know, I think the essential element in any coalition is trust. And at Innovate EDU, we actually have a manifesto. People can go and read it on the website. The cool type of manifesto, not the bad type of manifesto, but really it talks about how do you find the 80% common. So not every organization, no matter the scope, is going to agree on everything, but can you agree on what's 80% common? And this is something that actually comes from technology and a discipline around enterprise architecture. So when you're an enterprise architect, you design 80% of the system, and then you allow different units, different branches, different applications to customize the 20%. And so we experience this all the time in our daily life. If you look at Uber and Lyft, for example, they have the exact same payments infrastructure, the exact same Google Maps infrastructure. Like 80% of their architecture is common, right? But what is different is both their, what they're trying to connote in their customer experience, their brand, but also just sort of the type or segment of the market they're going after. And so if you can build a coalition that's built on trust and finding common ground, that 80% common, not agree on 100%, that's never going to happen. Don't ever go into a coalition thinking I'm going to have a universal agreement. That's just not what happens as humans. But can you create a space where there's trust that when there is that 20% disagreement, it's comfortable to disagree and to say, this is where I need to step back and say I'm not in alignment, or this is what would help me get to alignment. How do you create the space for radical candor? How do you create the space where you can build trust and use trust in order to, you know, kind of work towards hard conversations? One of the things I think that's really impactful about Innovate EDU is it's not uncommon for us to have coalition partners that are shared across our different coalitions and our different projects. Why is that? It's because we've built the trust. It's because they trust Innovate EDU. They trust that we're going to be honest brokers in this work and that, you know, we're going to always say the hard thing, which is something that I think can be really challenging, but we always say the hard thing, even if we know it's going to get us into that 20% zone where we have to sort of surface it, do it in a way that's safe and allow people to find a pathway forward.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Okay. Another question for you, Erin. So this show is all about thought leadership and education. And clearly you've carved a path for yourself that's so impressive through the work you're doing, but also the platform that you built for Innovate EDU, Project Unicorn, and your own brand. So I would love for you to share any takeaways or strategies for success that you think our listeners could apply when they're trying to build their own audiences and grow their own impact.
Yeah. I mean, I think something that I've learned and had to like evolve in is first, I think I've always been this way to just be really authentic. But the thing I've really had to grow in is to be a vulnerable leader, to say when I need help and to say when I need thought partnership and to also never try to act like I have all the answers. And that my greatest strength is the fact that I can call a lot of really smart people when I have a challenge. And I think that's really important. I think we don't see vulnerability as a superpower, and we should. Vulnerable leaders get more done. They're more authentic. They're able to build trust much more easily. And I don't think when you would have asked me 10 years ago, that would have been my answer about building my own brand. I thought it was confidence and, you know, always like fake it till you make it. We hear that a lot. You know, I think at some point, authenticity is your currency. And unless you're an authentic, vulnerable, trustworthy person, it's really hard to get people to trust you, to get people to work hard with you and on an issue, even when it gets tough. And I think I have been really blessed and really lucky to be able to build those relationships. I've also had really great mentors my whole life. I've had really amazing people in my life who are willing to hold up a mirror to me and say, you're not being your best self, or I think you could do this differently, or this is how you navigate being a working mom, because people have gone before me and, you know, have been vulnerable, have built that trust with me. And so whenever people ask me about building their brand, I want people to think about, like, what is your authentic voice? And to really lean into that authenticity, even if that authenticity is vulnerability, even if that authenticity is personal. And I think when you do that, when you demonstrate that you can be radically candid in a situation, that you can show people that, you know, you're willing to reach out and ask for help, to lean on their expertise, to put a partner out front, those are the things that I think have made the work we've done at Innovate EDU so notable. We're also really urgent. That's the other thing I want to say. People remark all the time that we get things done so fast and we have a sense of urgency. You know, we feel that urgency every single day. I feel so urgent about what's happening in our education system right now. I feel more passion and more urgency right now than when I did, you know, 9 years ago when I founded Innovate EDU. I talk to superintendents and that doubles down on my urgency. I talk to parents and that doubles down on my urgency. I had such an awesome journey last week. I got to go into some San Diego schools with our Educating All Learners community of practice and talk to students and to teachers. As an education sector, we need to be centering the field more. We need to be more inclusive and we need to be listening more. And when we listen, we can both respond with the urgency and sort of the appropriate thing that the field needs at that moment.
I think I'm going to lean into this moment because it was so well timed of you talking about your leadership. But before we started recording, we were all kind of sharing the woes of motherhood. And I think, again, well-timed because Sarah's kids are jumping in the background of this recording. So that's why we've just brought it to the table. She's like muting herself and trying to multitask here. So I think it's valid. Erin, share with us where you started to go. And then we said, freeze, let's start recording. Tell us about what you kind of stood up for as a female CEO and being a mother and all that comes with that.
Yeah, I think it starts with that vulnerability and getting comfortable. You know, just before the pandemic, we were doing a series of panels with other women leaders in the space, one at South by Southwest EDU, one at iNicole, where we were talking about the challenges of being a woman leader, both in terms of the professional challenges, in terms of fundraising, or sometimes types of conversations you find yourself in, or the types of networks you're not a part of, to like the challenges of, you know, having to, you know, keep your kids out of Zooms, or if you have your kids in Zooms, make sure you're muted. You know, I think that there are a lot of challenges about being a working parent. I think that applies to moms and dads, but there is a special set of things that are not just driven by our sector, but frankly, are driven by society around moms who work. And I think we saw this in stark relief during the pandemic, when you saw how many women at all levels, from CEOs and VPs to folks who are more frontline workers, just left the profession, just left the workforce entirely. And I'm not throwing shade at anyone who did that. I embrace everybody who makes different choices, including folks who step back for lots of different reasons. But I just think that if we had an honest conversation about why that happened, what the enormous setback that is for our society and for business and for our sector, to see so many women leave work life at the start of a global pandemic, whether that's because childcare became non-existent or schooling became more difficult or work responsibilities shifted around, whatever it was and whatever it is for each individual family, as a society, we need to take a step back and say, why was that? And why are we so far behind all the progress that we had made? And, you know, whether you're the Prime Minister of New Zealand or you're the former governor of Massachusetts, my good friend Jane Swift talks about this, like, we have made progress, but we have not made enough progress in terms of how we treat women leaders and how we treat working moms. And, you know, I see this all the time when, you know, I'm lucky enough to be in the same sector as my husband. And sometimes we have the same funders, and a funder will say nothing to my husband, nothing to Eric, not ask about our kids, not ask about, you know, traveling. And the first question out of their mouth when they see me, and whether it's out of trying to form a relationship or friendship, they ask me how my kids are. They say, don't your kids miss you when you're on the road? And that just feels like a subtle channeling that, like, parenting is all my responsibility, and it's not. And so I think we need to name those things. And so some of the things that I've started to do is at conferences, upcoming at COSIN, I'm going to get together with a bunch of badass, can I say badass? I'm going to say it.
Yeah.
Female leaders in tech, to talk about the unique challenges of being a woman leader in tech in particular. And we need to call attention to that. Look at the number of women in education who are teachers, but that number does not translate to the number of women who are superintendents. What is happening there? Why is it that we think it's okay for women to be teachers and educators in our classrooms, but we're not comfortable with them being superintendents? You know, I think we have to do more and do better. And that's incumbent upon people like me, who are the leader of my organization, to both create that space and create those pathways. And so I'm here for that. And I always want to create that space. In a space of, again, like, no judgment, people need to have the power to make different choices. I just want women to be able to have that choice.
All Are you an education leader, the leader of an ed tech company, or a member of an organization supporting education? We continue to hear from leaders like you who have a story to tell, a message to share, or an important initiative that needs greater awareness. 3 years ago, that's exactly what we heard from Doug Roberts, the CEO of the Institute for Education Innovation, when he approached SWPR Group. This led to the launch of a groundbreaking new award that was unlike any other in EdTech. The SWPS Choice Awards, judged exclusively by K-12 superintendents, set IEI on a path to market dominance, increasing vendor partners and superintendent members by more than 30% year over year. Jamie Candy, the CEO of Edmentum, shared with SWPR Group the EdTech company's desire to tell district success stories and to elevate the leaders behind their organization in a more thoughtful and strategic way. Throughout the past 2 years, SWPR Group has established consistent and regular media coverage, authored compelling op-eds, and secured interviews highlighting success stories while also inserting Edmentum into timely topics like AI with national reporters. At SWPR Group, we provide public relations, communication strategies, and thought leadership support for today's changemakers and the brands they champion. We work together with our clients to bring their mission to life by consistently delivering high-quality content, creative communication strategies, and transformational results. What story do you want to tell? Reach out to us using the link in the show notes or visit our website at swpr-group.com.
I love this. This has been, Sarah and I have been having this conversation a lot lately in so many different ways. I'll share with you this just cute anecdote. So my girls have started a podcast. And what's really cute is one of their episodes they did, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's really about books they've read. Like, that's really what started out. Like,
I love it.
Yeah. So we were explaining, you know, in her story that like, when she had a young child while she's going through law school or whatever, and discussing that must have been challenging. And one of my daughters, it was just so profound. So I had to share this. One of my daughters was like, why wouldn't they just take turns? Why wouldn't her husband stay home like dad does? And I was just like, you go, girl. Like, that was like, she genuinely, that was her first reaction. It took me a moment of pause to be like, I don't know that I would have said the same. I would have had it ingrained to me that I wasn't allowed to say that, or not allowed, but like, it would have made such sense that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have stayed home with her kid. Why did it? And it didn't make sense to my daughter. And I was so proud of her that it didn't make sense. I just thought it was beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I love Nancy Pelosi and this anecdote she tells about getting into politics. And someone said, you know, when I saw the Pelosi kids and the fact that they were all folding their own laundry, I knew that Nancy could lead anything. Right. And so
that is so true.
Right. And so like, when you think about all the things that you have to do to multitask as a parent, and again, like, I want to be inclusive of our, maybe some of our grandparents who are out there who are parenting right now, or dads who are parenting right now, there is a special set of things that we need to do so that every young person, whether they're, I don't know, seven, Katie, your kids are seven. So whether they're seven or they're 17, still sees that as a possibility. That I want a 17-year-old girl to say that too. I want a 27-year-old young professional to be able to say that. I want a 37-year-old executive to be able to say that. And so how do we show that path in a way that, you know, makes it possible? And I also have some great girlfriends. You know, I created a happy hour at large education conferences called Lady Boss Hour, and it's ladies only. And we just, you know, have a cup of cocktails and decompress and create that space. And so men have been doing this for a really long time. Mm-hmm. It's time for us to create that space for women too, and to support each other. That's another thing. I've had really great female mentors and male mentors, but my female mentors have always said, under what conditions is this possible? Never know.
I love that.
Yeah, I love it too. That's amazing. So great. Okay, Erin, what are you hopeful about with the future of education? You're making so much positive change, and there's so many things still left that we need to fix. But where are you still hopeful about where we can transform the lives of young people moving forward?
I mean, my greatest fault is that I'm always an optimist.
I can tell.
And I think that that optimism is what feeds that urgency that I talked about earlier. You know, I'll tell you the things I'm really excited about. I'm really excited about the shift that I am seeing in parents as partners in so many of our schools. I love the work that National Parents Union is doing, Learning Heroes is doing, to really shift a conversation from parents as being in an adversarial relationship within the education system to a partnership relationship in the education system. And I think if the pandemic wasn't a wake-up call to schools and educators across this country, how vital it is that our parents are engaged in young people's education, then I don't know what better wake-up call we could have gotten. I love the progress we're seeing on accessibility, inclusivity, and interoperability. I was thrilled when Secretary Cardona declared that those were the three aspects of digital learning environments that we should all be promoting. I've just watched CAST, in partnership with Educating All Learners, release the first Universal Design for Learning certification for vendors to create those clear market signals for organizations around, you know, what tools are designed for all learners. And I think that's something we need to do more of in our space, is create clear market signals and decision frameworks for folks who are making decisions about choosing pedagogy, curriculum, you know, practice materials, anything like that. Let's make it much easier. And then I guess the last thing I'm really excited about, I have so many, but, you know, I'm going to use a story from last week when I was in San Diego at an amazing middle school, Calvera Middle School in San Diego. And I was there with a group of districts from across the country, from, you know, Vermont to Encinitas to Missouri to Idaho. So a real cross-section of districts. And they were there all focused on how to create more inclusive learning environments. And I walked into a classroom of middle schoolers who are all working on a design and engineering project. And each of these middle schoolers, and I can send you guys a video if you want to see this, because it's pretty awesome, were each working on an innovation that they had designed and then 3D printed in order to create a more inclusive sort of practical situation or life experience for someone who was differently abled. And so one team printed adaptive toothpaste caps to be able to unscrew a toothpaste cap so that if you were mobility impaired, you could get the toothpaste cap off. Or another group 3D printed a bag handle. So folks who maybe had a prosthetic limb or who didn't have mobility in both arms could carry more bags with a bag handle that would disperse the weight. Or another team that was printing a piece of plastic that flips over a key to make the key fob wider so that you can turn it if you have different mobility. And so the thing that gives me hope every single day is actually our young people. They are amazing, dynamic, caring, global citizens. And our job is to create the learning experiences that invest them in their own learning, that drive the type of social impact and change that I saw in this middle school classroom. We need to be thinking about creating those learning environments, creating those learning experiences, creating those working conditions for our educators so that they can help create those, creating those conditions for communication with our parents. That's the stuff that fills my cup. That's the stuff that makes me feel that urgency, because it's happening not just in a school in San Diego. It's happening all over our country. Our schools are amazing. Our educators are innovators. Our young people are catalysts for change. We need to figure out a way to unlock that power. And so that's what I'm committed to at Innovate EDU. That's what you're going to see us focused on. And that's why we build these uncommon alliances for change.
Mic drop. So great.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I really feel it. That's the thing. Like,
no, I can tell.
Yeah.
It's coming so off easy. You like fireworks. It's coming off you.
Good. Hope not fully in my closet with the fireworks.
That would be no, a hopefully not. Okay. Where can people find out about you? Oh, sorry. That's your question, Katie. You go.
No, I just wanted to say it's so great to meet you. And now I'm looking so forward to following your work. And that's a perfect segue to, where do we follow you? How do we learn more about you?
Yeah, well, I would love for you to learn more about Innovate EDU and our work at our website, www.innovateedunyc.org. You can always follow me on Twitter. I'm still there, @ErinMote, pretty easy. I post a lot on LinkedIn. Katie knows this. Everything from grant opportunities to the work we're doing at Innovate EDU. I tend not to post, you know, the funny things I post on Twitter about my kids, you know, running into a glass door and having a goose egg. If you want that, tune into Twitter. But LinkedIn is a little bit more. And then, you know, if you're interested in any of the areas that we're working in, whether it's Project Unicorn and our work on data interoperability, the Pathways Alliance and the work we're doing on educator preparation, I would urge you to follow those specific brands and handles. You can link to all that work from our main website at innovateedu.org.
Amazing. Thanks, Erin. And we'll be sure to include the video you talked about in the show notes.
Yeah. I'll send it to you. It's just a mobile video. And I took it so you can't see the kid's face because so I could share it on social media.
Brilliant. It's not your first rodeo.
Pretty serious.
Yeah, it's not your first rodeo.
It's not my first rodeo, that's right. No, but they're pretty awesome. I mean, it was like soul-filling to watch.
Amazing.
These young people. I just think young people are capable of far more than we give them credit for. And if we center them in our work, it can give you that fire, that passion, that urgency.
Yes, I totally agree. Completely agree. Amazing. All right. Well, Erin, so great to have you and can't wait to keep following you and watching you do amazing things. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Will you just send me an email and I'll send you that video?
Absolutely. No problem.
Great.
Okay.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, y'all.
If you're looking for more of this thought leadership goodness for your organization, you're in the right place. Visit us at swpr-group.com to learn more about how we work with education organizations and their leaders, superintendents, and influencers to increase your impact. Again, that's swpr-group.com. Thanks for tuning in today, and we will see you next time on Build Momentum.